Hello, it's Thursday, April the 8th. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show, coming as ever from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, I'm going to be talking to the well-known author and TV GP, Miriam Stoppard. She thought COVID might kill her back in February. Now she's had her second vaccine. She's telling us all we've got to stay vigilant. Should we all be working from home forever? Some people seem to think so. Others say it will be especially bad for women, because it will affect their career prospects. Watchdog scientists and politicians are all urging British people to keep faith with the AstraZeneca vaccine, and I'm certainly going to, because I'm having my second one in a few weeks' time. But first, an extraordinary film video. You wouldn't think there's any more that could surprise us, of the Queen and Prince Philip being broadcast on ITV to mark Her Majesty's 95th birthday. A charming, newly unearthed home video from 1953 has captured the Queen and Prince Philip, and you've heard this phrase before, but I think it's true this time, as they've never been seen. The footage is in New Zealand and various other parts of a seven-month Commonwealth tour, and it's part of an ITV documentary marking Her Majesty's 95th birthday this month. It's called The Queen Unseen. Joining me to discuss this is Rebecca English, the Daily Mail's Royal Editor. Rebecca, what's interesting about this? We have sort of seen photographs. I don't think I've ever seen the Queen tucking into a piece of fruit before, but there she is eating an orange.
Yeah, it's lovely, isn't it? I mean, as you say, Andrew, yeah, a lot of people say, oh, this is unseen or rare footage, but I mean, this genuinely has never been seen in public before. And I don't know if people know that might know, but the Queen doesn't eat in public because it's a bit unseemly. So to see her tucking into an orange and also handing a piece over to a Yugoslavian dictator, General Tito, is just extraordinary.
Amazing. And it's not any old dictator. It's Marshal Tito, her first ever visit, we think, to a communist country. And as ever, she got on incredibly well with him, as she does with all these old despots she's had to put up with over the years of her reign.
And I think it's exactly that. It shows you what a remarkable international stateswoman we have. I mean, really, when it comes to that, when it comes to her banging the drum for Britain on the world stage, she has never put a foot wrong. And apparently, Tito, I think he was approaching his 80th birthday at the time, specifically asked to meet her. That was the one thing he wanted to do. And we saw that fairly recently again, didn't we, when President Trump came to the UK. You know, he wanted to meet the Queen. He had enormous respect for her. And this is a really good example of what they refer to in Whitehall as a soft diplomacy of the royal family.
Yeah, and then there's this lovely footage, isn't there, with Patricia Norrie, the wife of the Governor General of New Zealand, showing Prince Philip trying and failing to get on a lilo. I don't think you'd ever see anything like that. And I bet you Prince Philip won't be too pleased either that this is coming out.
Well, probably not, but probably as he's approaching 100th birthday, maybe he's a bit more
Who cares
about these things.
Yeah,
But you know, again, we don't get to, you know, the Queen is, you know, she's been our head of state, you know, for almost 70 years, and yet she's still such an enigma. We know so little about her, and I think this is why it's so lovely that they were on this big seven-month Commonwealth tour. It was really grueling. She was away from her two young children, but they had a bit of downtime in New Zealand, where it was summer, obviously, over the Christmas period. And they stayed with the Norries. They were given Christmas stockings. Apparently, in the Queen's Christmas stocking, there was a dog lead, which she loved.
Amazing.
And in Philip's Christmas stocking, there was a Wedgwood ashtray, which he got the giggles about because it actually had his wife's head on it as well, which they all thought was very funny. And then they went to the pool after lunch. And interesting, you'll see from the Mail today that, you know, the Queen doesn't disrobe and get in the pool as well. I think she's always very mindful of her public image, but she was really relaxed and laughing and videoing her husband from the side of the pool, and was happy to be videoed by the Governor General's wife. And Philip was obviously completely relaxed. I mean, larking around in a pair of budgie smugglers, jumping in and off the lilo. You know, I think it's just nice to remind people that this is what they can be like.
They are a family after all, aren't they? They're not just a royal family. They are a family as well. And there's a lovely, just finally, Rebecca, there's a lovely picture of a rather chubby, charming Prince Andrew in his mother's arms at Balmoral. I think it's probably the first colour image of Prince Andrew, much loved in those days, of course.
Yeah, apparently so. It is one of the first kind of images. And apparently this is something that the documentary highlights. I think it's a really fascinating documentary. It's on tonight, by the way, on ITV at 9 o'clock.
And 9 o'clock.
Definitely worth a watch. I really enjoyed this documentary. But they made a point of saying that this seven-month Commonwealth tour the Queen had been on, it really did take it out of her. And people have this image of her as quite an uncaring and distant mother. But I always argue that's because she was the ultimate working mother. You know, she had no choice but to get stuck into a role. And unfortunately, her family did suffer slightly as a result. But after that trip where she was parted from Charles and Anne for so long, she vowed to be much more of a hands-on mother. And I think you can see that in that photograph of her with Andrew.
Absolutely. That is Rebecca English, our award-winning royal editor, talking about The Queen Unseen, which is on ITV tonight at 9 p.m. And I'm going to be glued to it. Why don't you visit melplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, of course, along with all our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. Watchdogs, scientists, politicians, they've all urged British people to keep faith with the AstraZeneca vaccine after extremely rare cases of blood clots sparked debate over its safety in Britain and the EU. In Britain, under 30s will now be offered jabs made by other companies such as Moderna and Pfizer. I'm joined now by Dr. Ellie Cannon, who is, of course, the Mail on Sunday's resident GP. Dr. Ellie, I'm one of those people of a certain age. I've had my first AstraZeneca and I have no qualms whatsoever about having my second. And that's the right approach, isn't it?
It really is. Vaccination is all about weighing up the risks versus the benefits. And for the majority of us, the risks of COVID far outweigh any hypothetical risks or very rare risks from a vaccination. But I suppose as we go into the much younger age groups who we've been told rightly over the last year are really not at risk from severe illness from COVID, it's hard then to weigh up the risks versus the benefits when there appears there might be even a tiny risk from the vaccination.
And it's interesting that in Britain, the medical regulator is saying to people under 30, have an alternative if you prefer, such as Pfizer or Moderna. In Europe, the European regulator, where we know there's been a lot of aggro about the AstraZeneca vaccine, the European regulator never even went that far.
Yes, well, I do think we have to maintain the confidence within the vaccine programme. And I think Europe, unfortunately, has not done particularly well in that, backwards and forwards, in terms of what they are offering. And this is just another nail in the coffin, unfortunately, for their sort of vaccine hesitancy levels. In this country, I think we appreciate how important it is to maintain the confidence, and thankfully we do have Moderna and Pfizer vaccinations available. And also, we're not actually at the stage yet of vaccinating 20 and 30 year olds, so we do have some time to actually start to organise ourselves so those patients could actually opt into a different vaccination, which is probably unnecessary given the tiny numbers, but I think would be necessary in terms of trust and confidence in the programme.
Yeah, and to put it in context, I think, is it 19 fatal blood tumours associated with people who'd had the AstraZeneca jab, although there is no certain evidence that the jab was responsible. But that's out of 20 million jabs that were administered, which is an almost infinitesimal number, isn't it?
It is, it is. You're looking at deaths at a rate of 1 in 2.5 million. But it may be that within certain groups of the population, for example, young women or women with certain medical backgrounds or on certain medications, they are the people who are at this very slightly increased risk. And it's important we're looking at those signals, we're watching what's going on. Anybody who's had their AstraZeneca vaccination already is absolutely fine to go back for their second one. And it's a continuing process, and we just need to keep vigilant.
I was talking just finally, Dr. Ellie, to a politician yesterday who said, do you do realise about 1,000 people a year die falling down the stairs at home, which is a far greater risk to life and limb than having the AstraZeneca vaccine and blood clots? And I thought that puts it in a rather good context, really.
That is correct. Running up and down the stairs, getting into a car, a lot of everyday things carry a risk, but we don't scrutinise those things the way we are scrutinising COVID and our response to COVID. And unfortunately, that really is the problem at the moment. We are watching these vaccination trials in action. We're watching the drug trials. This is our rolling news at the moment. And in a mass vaccination program, of course, everybody's eyes are going to be on those vaccinations. There was probably a better way to highlight the issue to doctors and vaccinators and regulators without creating the mass panic that I think this has created.
Yeah, just finally, are you aware anecdotally of people cancelling planned vaccinations because of concerns over AstraZeneca, or do you think most people are being calm and collected and just getting on with it?
I'm hoping most people are being calm. I've been in clinic today and we've taken a few calls from patients who want to be checked for a blood clot because they had an AstraZeneca vaccination a few weeks ago, even if they have no symptoms. People who want to ask if they should still have it. There's certainly a level of concern there. And we've even actually sent patients to A&E because they have symptoms that I would imagine will not turn out to be a blood clot, but we can't ignore them now that this news is out there.
Absolutely. That's Dr. Ellie Cannon, who is, of course, the Mail on Sunday's resident GP. If you enjoy The Andrew Pearce Show, please subscribe to us. You can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Google or Spotify. And if you want to get in touch, tweet us at Mail Plus or me at Tory Boy Pearce. Should we all be working from home forever? It's a subject under debate, not just in this country, all around the world. And after Twitter's Jack Dorsey said that employees, in his view, could work from home for good. But is it good for business? Will employees demand it as a perk? And is it good for career prospects? I'm joined now by Romany Thomas, who's the founder and chief executive at Juggle Jobs. Romany, I must ask, first of all, are you working from home?
I am indeed.
And have you been from the beginning of the lockdown?
I have, yes. We actually were operating on a hybrid model when we went into the first lockdown back in April, and then we've decided to move fully remotely, and I am absolutely doing it myself.
Right. And how many people do you have working for you? How many are working from home? Do you link in with them via Zoom, FaceTime, that sort of thing?
So there's 12 of us. We do check in every day for 15 minutes at the start of every day. And then during the week, so we're pretty rigorous about planning at the start of every month or every quarter. So we're all really clear on the goals that we're working towards and what we're expected to deliver. But the whole point of this is not to replicate what we do in real life, so to speak, and just do all of those meetings over Zoom instead, because you know one just gets very tired if you try and do that. It's just exhausting.
So how do you manage to make the business function if you're not in constant communication with your colleagues, or can you do it by email?
Yeah, so we have an internal chat system called Slack, which a number of companies
use. Oh yes, yes,
so
I've heard of that.
So that's
yeah.
largely used for if we need to ask a question here and there. But we just put a lot more emphasis on the planning, which a lot of companies can do, to be perfectly frank. You can go into much more granular detail about actually what are we delivering, why, who is responsible for what, so that when you start every month, it's really clear about what that person needs to deliver, and the work becomes much more about outcomes, which is better suited to a remote environment anyway. So then how that person delivers is really up to them.
Some people argue, and you'll be aware of the arguments better than most, of course, that for a woman in particular, working from home is not advantageous because invariably the woman gets burdened with more of the childcare. Therefore, they're going to be working from home while perhaps some of their male colleagues are back in the office dare I say it, fluttering their eyelashes at the bosses, going to all important meetings while working mum from home, can be left behind, and that can impact on her career prospects.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Andrew. Companies need to decide which they are. Are they an office-based culture? And I would probably put hybrid working as an office-first environment, or are they remote working and embracing everything that comes with that? Because then you're right, the halfway house, it becomes very difficult and you end up with a two-tier system. I think it is also really important to distinguish something here as well, that we're talking about remote working in the context of a pandemic, which is forced, and there's no social time period, apart from very recently as lockdown's starting to lift. So we're all craving that kind of human contact, which is a deep need within all of that us, which is different to remote working in a normal environment where you just have a lot of autonomy and control over your schedule, and you do see the people that you love as well. So we have to, I think, be careful to separate the two, and companies need to make decisions based on the good version of that, not the one that we're in at the moment.
And what do you do, just finally, Romy, about your working day? If you were in the office, possibly you might consider a 9 to 5, 9 to 6, 9, 10 till 6 or something like that. Do you adapt your hours to suit yourself at home, or do you still largely operate as if you were in an office doing a, dare I say it, a 9 to 5 style operation?
Yeah, that's a good question. I personally work slightly longer hours, but I take longer breaks. For example, so in an office-based environment, you almost sort of grab a sandwich and eat at your desk and then you're off again. Whereas personally for me, and I think a lot of people are the same, I will actually take the time to cook my lunch, you know, maybe have lunch with my partner and we talk for, and even take that full hour that you'd expect in a lunch break, but then perhaps work a bit longer. And I personally enjoy the structure, but I know a lot of people have intermingled with their personal lives as well, and that's part of the joy of remote working.
And your colleagues just find it, they like working from home, they're enjoying it too. They're not sort of crawling up the wallpaper.
No, not at all. Some of the younger ones are again craving the social contact. So we've made sure that they get an office pass, and they can go in now as soon as things start opening up, whenever they want, and socialising with each other. But actually, you know, they love the remote first approach, and it's just very clear where we stand as well, which works for them.
That was Romy Thomas, who's the founder and chief executive at Juggle Jobs. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, it's now time for our regular city update with Hugo Duncan, who is the deputy business editor at the Daily Mail. Well, Hugo, if you've got a few shares and a pension, feeling pretty good today? Stock market doing rather well.
That's right, Andrew. Shares are on something of a roll. In fact, the FTSE 250, which is the mid-cap index, a lot of very domestically focused stocks from Royal Mail to M&S, at a record high.
Is it really?
The FTSE 100, not quite at a record high, but its highest level for a year. Now, this is, of course, quite a turnaround. You will recall at the start of last year, as the COVID pandemic struck, stock markets around the world, the UK included, absolutely imploded. The FTSE 100, the bit of blue chip stocks, the biggest companies, they lost over a third of their value. The FTSE 250 was down more than 40% at one stage. So it has been quite a turnaround.
And is it because of the success of the rollout of the vaccine? People see that as kickstarting an economic recovery.
That is indeed a very large part of it. Shares did start recovering, but only slowly through spring and the summer last year. But the really big impetus came in early November, which you will recall is when the Pfizer vaccine, the first one to get fully approved, to show that it worked. And as soon as that one was approved, other approvals came. The vaccine rollout has started, and so far in this country in particular has been very, very successful. And that has really boosted confidence about the outlook for the economy.
And the IMF and other organisations have been pretty bullish, haven't they, about Britain's prospects for the next 12, 18 months?
They have. We suffered one of the sharpest recessions among the major developed countries. But this year we are expected within the G7 to be one of the best performers. And next year, they think, the IMF thinks, that Britain will be the fastest growing economy in the world. So hopefully that will continue to be good for share prices, which is great for anyone with a pension or savings in ISAs and other investments.
That's me.
Congratulations.
Very happy. That's Hugo Duncan, Deputy Business Editor at the Daily Mail. So the author and GP, Dr. Miriam Stoppard, feared the worst. She thought she might die when she caught COVID in February last year because she had an existing lung condition. Now she's had her second vaccine, but warns we're not out of the woods yet, and she's telling people we must stay vigilant. Dr. Stoppard joins me now. Dr. Stoppard, I've been reading you for a very long time. People will be hanging on your words. Do you think people perhaps are becoming too complacent because of the success of the vaccine rollout?
Yes, well, you know, we're on a journey, and I don't think we're more than halfway yet to the end of the journey. The vaccination story is amazing, miraculous, in fact. Nobody could have even envisioned that it would be as successful as it has been, and thanks to all those who have made it happen. But there's the possibility that pockets of the virus will remain, and if, for instance, we become careless or complacent and start to, you know, join in large numbers in enclosed spaces, which is the ideal place that the coronavirus circulates, we'll get spikes again. And something that I don't think people understand, and that is that while the virus is in people, we get variants. Variants can come from abroad, of course, South Africa, Brazil, but in this country, variants occur within people when they've got the coronavirus. So the more people who have the virus, the more variants we will get. And so we have to be on red alert for quite a while to come in order to make sure that the numbers of people with the virus is kept low. And that's why we need still social distancing, wearing of masks, and test and trace. And frankly, I think we should maintain social distancing for, you know, for the future. It's such a useful way of keeping the numbers down. Wearing masks is such a useful, simple way to keep the numbers down. And I think we should just accept them as habits that we're going to have to adopt in order to keep the virus and its variants under control.
Yeah, because, I mean, you speak at an interesting time, because on Monday, April the 12th, we get the first stage of the next stage of the lockdown. People can go to pubs and restaurants if they've got an outside space. Non-essential shops will open. Is your worry that people will be forgetting to wash their hands, forgetting about social distancing and thinking, oh, well, I've had the second vaccine or I'm about to have the second vaccine, I'll be fine?
Well, yes, I do. And I think anywhere where alcohol is on sale, there has to be rather strict precautions, because alcohol loosens the inhibitions, makes us careless, makes us not notice things, makes us want to fling our arms around people, which is all very nice. But all of those things encourage spread of the virus. So, I mean, I think there has to be a division between inside and outside. Outside in the open is nowhere near as dangerous as inside, because the flow of the air, and particularly if there's a breeze, just carries all the COVID particles away. But indoors, without ventilation, in a low-ceilinged room, the virus can concentrate itself, and there's more likelihood of you picking it up. So I would advise everyone, even though there's relaxation that you can go into a pub, by all means get your drinks, but drink outside and try to do all your socializing outside, even though it's bitterly cold. I know it's not very attractive, and you have to be pretty hardy to do that. But it's worth it. You see, when I hear people putting forward arguments that, you know, we've got to relax the restrictions more quickly, our freedom is being curtailed, our civil liberties are under threat, I kind of gasp in disbelief, because the alternative, not to put too fine a point on it, is death. Death is the alternative to opening up. To opening up everything. And the other thing, the people who are, I mean, everybody wants to get back to work, everybody wants to get businesses going again. But the thing is, you can't have a healthy economy without a healthy population. So the first prerequisite of a healthy economy, healthy business, healthy of all kinds, is a healthy population. People have to be healthy to support that. So the health concerns, to me, come first.
And just finally on that, you, of course, you've had COVID and you would have developed antibodies, presumably. You've had your second vaccine, but nevertheless, you are still going to be very cautious in the weeks and months ahead. It sounds to me like you'll probably still be wearing a mask, Dr. Stoppard, come Christmas.
Well, I will be wearing a mask for the foreseeable future if ever I go into a shop. And if ever I find myself with a lot of people, I carry a mask with me all the time, and I would put it on if I found myself in what I thought was dodgy circumstances. Yes, I would. And I will practice social distancing for as long as I can. I mean, I walk in the park every day, and what I've noticed is that people socially distance even in the park. If you're going up the same path and you're coming, somebody's coming towards you, we automatically step aside so that there's 2 meters between us. We just do it automatically. Well, I think that's got to happen. If you're in a crowded street, well, I found when I was in London the other day, and I was in Oxford Street, I was walking in the road rather than on the edge of the road rather than the pavement, so that I didn't meet a lot of people. And I think we just have to be alert, continue with our good habits, because it's going to help us to get out of this.
Very good advice. That's Dr. Miriam Stoppard with sage advice. The lockdown may be being eased next week, but be careful, even if you've had your second jab. Great to talk to you, Dr. Miriam. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I am Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.